Welcome to the What Bitcoin Did podcast.
Hello there from Bedford. How are you all? Yes, I'm back home. I'm back in the global center of Bitcoin media, back getting my shit together. Been away for a while. I've got so much to catch up on. Anyway, welcome to the What Bitcoin Did podcast, which is brought to you by the Mighty Kraken, the best place to buy, sell, and trade Bitcoin. I am your host, Peter McCormack, and today I have an interview with Tuur de Meester on the Bitcoin Reformation. But before that, I do have a message from my amazing show sponsors, and make sure you check them out. It's because of the sponsors I get to do all these great interviews. So first up, it is BlockFi. Yes, the amazing BlockFi. Yes, the future of Bitcoin and financial services. And with today's show, you will understand why companies such as BlockFi are so important to Bitcoin, bringing the layer of financial services to the space. And BlockFi are the best in the sector. They are building a powerhouse in Bitcoin for borrowing and lending, and they've done it without any bullshit token. So if you need a crypto loan for your Cybertruck, you want to get a flamethrower, you want to take a trip to the moon, or because you've got to pay the man, BlockFi have got you covered. And if you want to earn interest on your Bitcoin, Ether, or GUSD, well, they've dropped all minimum deposits and they have removed the early withdrawal penalty, and you can receive interest in the currency of your choice. I am a customer and I do love getting my interest each month. I love that my Bitcoin is working for me. So if you're interested in checking them out, I recommend you do your own research, then head over to BlockFi.com, which is BlockFi.com. And next up, we have the mighty, mighty Kraken, the best place to buy, sell, and trade Bitcoin. And let's be completely clear why Kraken is the best and consistently rated the number one exchange in the world. Firstly, they are the most secure exchange for trading Bitcoin. No filthy hacker is going to be getting to your Bitcoin. And if you didn't listen to my show with Nick Pococo, their chief security officer, please do go and check that out. It was an amazing show. And for you advanced traders out there, they have the best account management service you could ask for. And they also have an unrivaled suite of trading products. They've got Kraken.com, the best place to buy, sell, and trade digital currencies. You crazy hardcore traders out there, they've got margin trading with up to 5x leverage. They've got futures and they've got indices. They've got the Kraken OTC desk for large trades with private and personalized services. They've also got CryptoWatch, where you can trade on multiple exchanges from a single platform. And they've just released Kraken Pro, a beautiful mobile-first app so you can trade on Kraken wherever you want. It doesn't matter if you're on the bus, if you're on a plane, if you're sat in the passenger seat of a car, if you're in Starbucks, if you're at the McDonald's drive-thru. If you want to buy some more Bitcoin, you can do it on the go with Kraken Pro. You can find out more at Kraken.com or download the app, which is available for the iPhone and Android. Just search for Kraken Pro, which is K-R-A-K-E-N-P-R-O. Okay, so on to my show with Tuur de Meester. And my last interview with Tuur, Bitcoin is in Heavy Accumulation, was a massive episode. I think it's like my fourth biggest episode. And so while I was out in Austin, I knew I had to get him back on the show. So Tuur just released a new article called The Bitcoin Reformation, which drew parallels between the 16th century Protestant Reformation, where people challenged the power and authority of the Roman Catholic Church, which led to greater political and cultural freedom, with Bitcoin in today's world. It's an amazing piece of writing, and I knew once I'd read it, we had to make a show about it. I reached out to Tuur straight away. I said, look, when I'm over, let's make a show. And I was out there, I was out in Austin, so we recorded a show all about this. So we get into the article, the distrust in the banking and political systems, and if Bitcoin is the essence of rebellion. So I hope you like this one. I loved it. But you got any questions, you know you can reach out to me. My email address is hello@whatbitcoindid.com. Just a couple of notes. I'm back in Bedford now. Got to get up to speed on a few things. I've been away for so long. So much to catch up on. But next week, I'm going to be heading out to Uruguay for La BitConf. Probably going to be going via Buenos Aires and hopefully heading out to Bolivia for a couple of days for my other show, Defiance. So hopefully I will get to hang out with a few of you there. Anyway, if you've got any questions about the show, do reach out to me. My email address is hello@whatbitcoindid.com. So I want to move out here and...
What?
To Austin, or where? To the States.
US, yeah.
I want to move to the States. I originally always wanted LA because... I like it in LA, but I don't think it's great for the kids. And then I thought New York's better for work, especially, I don't know if you know, I've got a second show now called Defiance.
Well, I know you're killing it with the Bitcoin show.
Well, that's going well, but I've got this other show, Defiance, and that's, so in New York, there's an interview you can do every day. But again, I'm do I want to live here and with my kids? But I'm now actually thinking about Austin.
Well, so consider that 75% of the Texas population lives in the Texas Triangle, which is within a three-hour drive of here. So that's like 20 million people. So if you look at it that way, it's kind of, you're in a in a metro area, it's a really, like, lots of people live here.
Well, what I've got to think of is, like, you know, I like to do my interviews in person.
Yeah.
We've only done one remote. Is this your fourth one?
Third. One remote and one live in San Francisco.
Yes, your third one then. But I prefer them in person. So actually, interestingly, the one we did remotely is my third biggest show. The Bitcoin and Heavy Accumulation, that one blew up. But, you know, I prefer them in person. But the way it works now is if I'm based in the UK, I come out for I'm going to be here for 2.5 weeks. I'm going to record 30 interviews over those 2 weeks, which is grueling. But then I'm set up for a month.
Yeah.
And my kids stay with their mum. But if I come out here and my son will come with me, it's just kind of like, all right, I can interview you and I can interview Bitstein and Jimmy. There's maybe 10 people here.
Yeah, not very many.
But am I still going to have to travel? Can I get people to come in? Will I end up doing more remote? But in the end, it's kind of like some places I could go in and out of in a day. But lifestyle-wise, it feels like Austin's the place to be.
I think so. Yeah, I love Austin. I think first of all, it's growing so fast. There's this kind of really entrepreneurial culture here, and it's 150 years ago there were 40,000 people in the entire state of Texas, so like pretty much everyone was an immigrant at some point coming in here, and you can really feel that there's really kind of this, you know, people, they have the guts to think big and they're just building a lot of cool stuff, and it's diversified as well. Like if you look at all the different industries that are present in Texas. And then, you know, here in Austin, there's UT Austin, the university.
No state tax.
Yeah.
That's the thing that's drawing me in. But the other thing is also, I feel like Austin has become, like, there's no real home of Bitcoin, like, it's everywhere. But I feel like there's a real density building around here, like a real density of Bitcoiners.
I mean, not that influencers are everything, but I had a look at the, what is it now, the Hive.1 top 100 Bitcoin influencers.
Yep.
And to my knowledge, 6 of them now live in Austin, and that's double that of 2 years ago.
Where are you on that list, though? You're like top 10, aren't you?
Yeah, somewhere in there. I mean, it depends on what list. There's so many lists. But I like Hive.1 because it's kind of, it's based on who follows each other. And so it's like the Google PageRank idea. And so if some other influencers follow you, then you go up in the ranking. So I do like that approach.
I dread the email every week because I'm like, the email every, because I'm a bit of a lunatic and a bit confrontational. Every week, the email that comes in that tells you who's followed you new and who's unfollowed you, it's always like, fuck, who have I pissed off this week? And I kind of like, sometimes I just delete it because I don't want to know.
Yeah, and then sometimes
I open it with a squint and I'm like, oh shit, I've pissed off this person this week. They've unfollowed me. Like I've had some brutal unfollows.
But have you ever repaired ties? Like somebody who blocked you that you then like...
Yeah, I've interviewed, I think on 3 occasions now, I've interviewed people who I'm blocked by.
Oh, that's awesome.
So Eric Voorhees, the first time I interviewed him, I was blocked by him. And I didn't know why, and he didn't know why. And we did the interview, and I said to him, oh, yeah, by the way, I'm blocked. He's like, really? And I was like, yeah, I don't know why. So we went and searched Twitter, and it was back. I was very, very new. And it was during S2X, and I just said something outrageous. Mm-hmm. It was really outrageous. I apologized, and he unblocked me, and I consider us friends in the world of Bitcoin. If I want to do an interview, he'll do it. But there's a few more. I've blocked a bunch of people as well. But I'm the kind of person who will block and have people block me. You're not, because you're not a confrontational person.
Yeah, I my block list is probably runs in the hundreds now, but I've been on Twitter for 10 years, so I'm pretty quick to block, but then if people ask, like, hey, you know, a friend of mine, he's blocked, like, would you mind unblocking? I usually just go ahead and do it.
I've done a mass unblock at once, and that was a terrible idea. I did it and said, look, let's start afresh, blah, blah, blah. Same people, straight in it.
Oh, yeah.
You're a moron, you're an idiot. So anyway, look, great to get you back on. Always great to get you back on. I know it's good for downloads, so it's always great to get you back on. That last show did really well. Like I say, it's my third biggest show, and the two shows are bigger was on like an Andreas one that blew up and like a very old one, but it did really well. People loved that show. And you were right. I mean, straight after that, Bitcoin went up to like 14K. You know, you got it right. How do you see it all now? Are we in like another accumulation period?
Yeah, so back then the report was called Bitcoin and Heavy Accumulation. So the idea was like the long-term holders are just holding on. And meanwhile, we have this new generation of investors who's piling in. And that's what I meant, like heavy, like really there was significant buying coming in. And now I think we've you know, the market got ahead of itself. People thought like, oh, this is easy. Like, this is like, you know, 2017 again. Let's just jump on board and go for another ride. And then, yeah, of course we did go to 14, but I think it's just, it was a bit too much too fast. And so this period now, there's a famous analyst called Wyckoff. And so he has this model of how markets develop. And so he talks about accumulation, which is at the bottom, but then the next phase is reaccumulation. So you get a rally and then the market needs a breather. They need to catch its breath and it kind of needs to shake off some more weak hands until finally you can go higher. Because that's how you go higher. If all the weak hands are gone, then there's nobody really left to sell the asset and then it just has to go up. So I think this is the phase now where, you know, from that point where we went to 14 all the way until now is all part of the reaccumulation. Like, we're way above the bottom of 3,000. Mm. And I don't think we're going back there. No. I think, you know, if anything, you know, maybe like a 5,000, we could touch that briefly. But in hindsight, I think it's all going to be part of this just wide band that we're trading in a range. And this is all a setup to just go into new all-time highs again, but it's going to take some time.
Yeah, I've seen some of the people, the doomers, saying, oh, we're going to go back to 3K. And I was like, I don't see it. But you know what? If we went to 5, even at 5, we're up on the year. You know, we're up from the 3. You know, if it's a new... As long as... Because my time horizon's changed, too. My time horizon now is like multi-year, possibly multi-decade. Like, I don't sell Bitcoin ever anymore. And so I'm not emotional about the price moves anymore, because as long as new bases keep establishing themselves, I feel quite comfortable.
Right. Well, and that's also the secret of having appropriate size, right? If you're not reliant on Bitcoin for your income, for example, then you can be a lot more relaxed about it. Yeah. Or if it's not your pension right away, then you can be more relaxed about it. But yeah, I mean, I was thinking, like, just, you know, the past week, I was like, man, this market, it's been 10 years, but it's still so volatile.
Yeah.
Like, we went from 9,000 to now 7.5 in what, a month again?
Mm-hmm.
Like, you know, so you would, and it's not totally peanuts anymore. Like, it's a $150 billion asset. So it definitely is scary. And I think part of the volatility is just that people still have trouble wrapping their head around, like, how do I know if... And it's binary. Like, either you believe it's going to a million or you believe it's going to die. Like, you can't really say, oh, it's just, you know, in 20 years from now, it'll still be bubbling at around $5,000. Like, you can't say that.
It's not going to happen. All right, well, listen, we're here to talk about your latest piece of writing, the Bitcoin. So, interestingly, I keep reading it as the Bitcoin Reformation. But I also, when I originally read it, I saw... the Bitcoin Reformation. So I was like, is it the Reformation? Is that like a term? Or is it the Reformation? Like, what is it?
Well, honestly, you catch me... I read a lot in English, but sometimes I honestly don't know what is the... I guess it would be Reformation in the sense that it's really a well-established way to describe this historic period. I didn't mean it literally. I didn't mean like Bitcoin is going to be reformed. Although, I mean, originally that's what that was. The 16th century is when a lot of very old institutions radically got reformed. And
I think it's your best piece of writing, by the way.
Yeah, I think it's the best I've done, especially in terms of tying together stuff that I'm passionate about. Because with, you know, there's only so much you can do with price analysis, and I. You know, it's always a bit sad if I put a lot of effort into a piece of writing that I know is going to stop being relevant 2 years down the road. Like, you know, Bitcoin and heavy accumulation, that's kind of gone now.
Yeah.
Of course, I can kind of like wave it around, but 5 years from now, nobody's going to remember maybe.
So
it's nice
to
put something together that I think hope is going to be relevant 10 or 20 years from now still.
Yeah, I mean, like if you're right, people will refer back to this, but it's a proper essay. And my assumption is that a good deal of work went into this. I'd love to ask how many times you edited it and reviewed it, because I'm imagining a few times. But I read it for a second time this morning, just in prep. I think it's fantastic. How long did it take you?
Well, it's hard to tell, because like part of the process was just... I was kind of like, I thought I was taking a break from Bitcoin. I was just doing reading. And I've always been fascinated by the differences in culture between Flanders, where I grew up, and Holland, the Netherlands, because there's the same language. But if you cross the border, you see everything changes. Like, you know, the houses are different. The people, the culture is different. And there is some research actually that confirms that the difference, the cultural difference between Flanders and Holland, that gap is the widest of any community that shares the same language and border pretty much anywhere in the world. And so then I was like, kind of like, I've always wanted to know, like, why is that? We're so close. So I started reading about the history, and then gradually it just became clear to me, like, oh. So what happened, I think the short of it is that the Rhine River is one of these major arteries in Europe. It starts in Switzerland, and then it goes all the way to, you know, the Antwerp and mm-hmm. the Netherlands now. That's where it ends. And so historically in the Middle Ages, it was this amazing trading route, right? And so a lot of wealth and people moved always. And so it's almost natural. It was almost like it had to happen that some bubble of prosperity had to develop at the end of that river, right? And so that's what happened slowly in the 15th century. Bruges, which is where I grew up, became very prosperous. And then Antwerp in the 16th century. All of those are very close to the end of the, how do you call it? The mound, maybe that's what it is, where the river goes into the ocean.
Oh, the mouth.
The mouth, the river. So that was kind of inevitable. And then with that, there was this constant flux of, you know, new immigrants coming in. Like, if you wanted to go to England, if you wanted to go elsewhere, you kind of had to go to the coast. Say that you're from France somewhere and you wanted to, you know, then you often would take the Rhine River to get there. So there was this kind of natural melting pot environment. And that's why, like, in the 15th century in Bruges, there was a Medici branch, like the Italian bankers. They decided to have a branch in Bruges and then in London, and so it was one of the major trading hubs. And so with that, it became like a place where radical ideas really found a friendly audience. Mm-hmm. And so gradually, people who were critical of the church, and they're like, "Hey, like, what is this? Like, we have to pay these enormous fees to make sure that we get into heaven. Like, what's that all about?" Like, and kind of not being anti-theistic, like, you're not anti-religious, but you're saying that, you know, the way this institution is handling it is not kosher. And so, anyway, I guess the short of it is what I discovered is that there was this growing rebellion in and the heart of the Netherlands at the time, because it was just one nation, like, there wasn't really a separation much. It was really the more on the Flanders side. If you looked at the amount of people that lived in what is now the Netherlands was maybe only a quarter of what lived people that lived in what is now Belgium. And the reason is that there was so many floods. Like, the it's all below sea level, and so you can't really build a big city. And they hadn't figured out how to build these dikes yet. So there was this prosperity and rebellion. And basically the Spanish, they had the largest empire on earth, because they had discovered the New World. They were, like, really mining, almost literally mining all the people there, the colonialism, and getting lots of precious metals. And also they had this kind of vision of grandeur, like they were God, ordained by God to rule Europe. And so they really were very expansionist, and they started pushing to conquer the Netherlands. And what happened is that they only got as far as Antwerp. So they basically were able to dominate and suppress whoever was in Flanders, but they never were able to conquer what is now the Netherlands.
Right.
Okay. And I think that really had a massive impact on the culture, where, like, the intellectuals and the merchants who had something to lose, they just moved up to Antwerp, to Amsterdam. And kind of who was left behind was, it became an impoverished area. If you look at the wages, for example, in the 17th century were 30% lower in Flanders versus Holland, just because the Spanish were there, they were, you know, levying taxes, there was censorship. So that, to me, has, like, I just have a lot of personal kind of attachment to this whole story, because I feel like, oh, finally I'm getting some answers as to why are people so different in Flanders versus Holland.
And what's going on here? So one of the interesting things about when I was reading it this morning, which I didn't notice the first time I read it, and perhaps it's because I wasn't reading it in prep for an interview. I just, I think as Meltem shared it and I read it, I was like, oh, that was cool. And I kind of skim read it because it was like a long piece. I actually sat this time and read it again for a second time, and the way I looked at it, it was quite like, away from the parallels of history, just in terms of Bitcoin itself, I kind of feel like if we look at the debates around Bitcoin at the moment, they're almost like, if you're looking at it through the lens of a camera, people are discussing price and are people spending it, quite, you know, quite basic rudimentary things. It's almost like you've looked at it with this wide lens. You're seeing the wider changes in culture and society, and you're seeing how Bitcoin is relevant and can impact that. And then you've drawn the parallels to history. So I kind of saw it this like tour as this, we're all seeing the world of Bitcoin in this very small lens, and you're looking through the wide lens.
Well, I mean, we'll see if I'm right, but that's what I've always attempted with Bitcoin, is like that this just is so different. It's so different from anything that I had ever seen before. And so how can I better understand it? And so I've always looked for, like, you know, are there any analogies that make sense? And so early on, a lot of people suggested, like, oh, it's like the early days of the internet. And that, I do think that makes sense. And then, you know, there's like, I did an exercise where I looked at the nascent petroleum industry in the US in the 19th century. But all those, and I've did several more of those exercises, but they always seemed a little too small to really convey what the meaning of all this could be. And so, and I feel like I was just luckily I stumbled upon this, where it just like, especially the notion that technology is an accelerant for forces that are already there, especially if you then also have a defensive component to your technology, where, you know, what were in the Netherlands of the 17th century, that was water. Like people started becoming, they started controlling this force of water. Of course, they were building ships, but then also first they would build dikes around certain areas where they had their farms and their lands. But then if you have dikes, that means you can control it. You can basically break the dike and let a whole area flood. And they use that strategically to fend off this. I mean, it's just this amazing story if you think of it. Like, there's this small bunch of rebels who fended off the largest empire in the world for 80 years, right? That's how long the 80 years war lasted. It's almost unprecedented. And the reason why they could do it is that, yes, they were prosperous, and yes, they had all kinds of innovative technologies, but they had in their favor this incredibly defensive force of water. Like, you know, they had a giant fleet. They could go to England if they wanted to as a refuge. And the Spanish were just not, you know, they didn't bring their armada over. They didn't build harbors. The Spanish had an army that walked across land all the way to Holland. And, you know, a lot of these soldiers just died in the mud, right? They were just, you know, they were flooded away. And so, yeah, so the comparison with today is like, well, wait a minute. Today we have cryptography, which is this incredibly powerful technology that allows people to defend themselves. Because I think that, you know, the battlefield, so to speak, is virtual now, right? It's a digital struggle, right? And the question is, like, how do we, you know, it's one thing to have all this fun innovation of like, ooh, like, yeah, Bitcoin, or we do our own currency, or this and that, but what if the going gets tough? Like, what if we really get traction with this and governments don't like it? Well, then there has to be a defensive component, and I do think that's there, and that's cryptography in general.
Well, so I've got the quote here. So let's go back a step. The reason it's relevant is because you identified a number of things. So you identified the fact that it's Bitcoin encryption, the internet, millennials, right? You identified them, and the millennials do not trust the institutions. And I'm guessing the millennials don't trust the institutions because, well, a number of reasons. You know, we've had a lot of bad press, we've had bad governments, we've had poor monetary policy, you know, we have millennials who are taking college degrees and struggling to get jobs,
right,
and then also struggling to get on the housing ladder, and they'll, you know, this kind of hatred that's come towards the boomers, right? But you identified that millennials don't trust the financial institutions. So I'll take the quote, because it was really, this is why I wrote it down. You've got, in the 21st century, the defensive technological suite available for people who question the economic status quo is cryptography, which can enable privacy and protection from asset seizure. In some ways, privacy is more important because it's more relevant to you, because I've never suffered asset seizure beyond the libertarian view that all tax is theft, right? So obviously, via tax, I have asset seizure by some people's. Are you referring here more towards asset seizure whereby in times of economic crisis, they literally pilfer the bank accounts, like what happened in Greece and Cyprus?
Yeah, that's one example. And then also, if you look at, you know, the Protestant Reformation, for example, what happened with the the Jews and the Protestants in Spain, for example, they were given an ultimatum. It was basically like, you know, either you get, I think it was like either 3 or 5 years. I think they were given like 3 years time to leave, and they had to pay an exit tax. And so not only did you have to leave, but then you also had to pay like 30% of all your assets. You just had to, you know, give. And then, of course, back then it was, you know, how do you even trust some guy across the border to keep your asset, you know, to keep your money for you? And then, of course, if you walk away from, if all the wealthy people of a certain area are forced to do the same thing, well, how much money are you going to get for your farm that you're abandoning? Probably not very much. So in a way, your farm is then also seized. And so, yeah, if I think about the future, it's just like having some way that reduces the cost of mobility is important. And that means not only like cheap airline tickets, but especially if you want to take your capital with you, how do you do that cheaply? And I think, you know, encryption, Bitcoin, things like that is I think it's basically the new offshore banking.
Well, if you forget volatility, because it is still kind of like the scary component.
Yeah.
You know, if the day you wanted to leave your country and move abroad and take your assets with you and put it in Bitcoin and it was at 14K and then 3 weeks later it's dropped to 9K, that is kind of terrible, right? But let's forget that component for now. Let's just imagine we have.
You can even subvert it, right? You can sell, if you have it in gold, you can sell your gold for Bitcoin. And then once you're established in your country of destination, you rebuy the gold.
But even that journey and that process of reestablishing yourself, you still have the risk of volatility. Yeah. But that, you know, that might be the risk worth taking. And it can work the other way. You could get there and we could have a rally and you'd be rich. But it's more the idea that you have that tool now that you didn't have before. But I don't think it's just millennials. I think it expands beyond millennials. I think there's plenty of people who feel disenfranchised with the current economic system and the economic status quo. I think there's a lot of people, you know, I certainly know from the UK, we're in the midst of an election and we have a conservative center and some policies center leaning, some points very far right leaning Conservative Party coming up now against a very left-wing, like almost extreme left-wing Labour Party now. And there are a lot of people disappointed with the economic status quo. So whilst I identify and agree with the millennials, I think it expands a bit beyond that.
Yeah, I mean, the reason why I've gone back and forth, like, should I pick the millennials? Like, you know, I could also just have said, oh, the Bitcoiners, right?
Yeah.
They're going to be the ones. And it is if you extrapolate, right? If you project that Bitcoin is going to be $1 million and you look at how many people, you know, today own how many Bitcoin, roughly speaking, it's not crazy to say that in 20 years from now, 30 to 50% of, I need to look up the exact calculation I did, but I think it was around at least 30%. 30% of the world's billionaires 20 years from now could be Bitcoiners. So that's basically a pretty radical shift. But then again, if you think about it, already 50% of today's billionaires have made their money through investing in technology. So that's also kind of already a generational shift because the younger people were just more ready to invest that in an early stage. And that's kind of where I'm thinking, like, you know, why does it make sense to pick millennials? They've, to some extent, their trust in the status quo has been shaken. Like, by definition, the millennial generation, they were consciously aware of the 9/11 attacks, which, you know, I don't mean it from a conspiracy angle, but just kind of like, you know, there's kind of a shift in terms of like, well, things that we took for granted, like, is everything so safe anymore? And then, of course, they're very aware. And as a young adult, the 2008 crisis. And so, of course, a lot of other people saw that too, the older generations. But I think especially the millennials are kind of digital native. So they, you know, they grew up, like I grew up streaming BitTorrent movies from my dorm room, right? My parents never were able to, they're like the cassette and radio generation. I would
throw another one in there.
Yeah, yeah.
More recent example. I think it's a bit of a segue, but I think the Epstein situation has created a bigger distrust in the system that there is potentially a deep state at work. And I think that's thrown another spanner in the works where people like, because that was something that seemed so obvious under our noses, that either it was somebody allowed to kill themselves who shouldn't, he should have been monitored, you know, or somebody killed him.
Right.
But that's another thing that I think, certainly for me, threw in another distrust of the system.
Right. Well, and also, even before that, if you think about like, well, you know, like how did he die and things like that, but it's also kind of like, how much rot is there that we weren't aware of previously? Like, we had the church scandals, mm-hmm. but the church is kind of, economically speaking, is like way down the ranks. And we had church scandals starting from the late 90s, like these pedophilia scandals. But now it seems like we're moving up, where it's like, oh my God, like, is the rot everywhere? Like, yeah. So I agree. I do think that that kind of contributes to this notion that don't trust everything that you've been told, right? Maybe there's people that you know, kind of like the priests. Like, priests are a good example because they always, you know, they talk a good deal about ethics and this and that. And so if a person like that is then credibly accused of abuse, then that really kind of shakes your trust in that whole affair of or what they're about.
Yeah. Well, it puts us in that position now where I think people are questioning money a bit more. Mm. I just think it wasn't something I was talking about with Bitstein. It's like, I wasn't taught it at school. I only became aware of thinking about money,
yep.
like to the extent where I consider it the way I consider it with Bitcoin and like its value now, its future value, the consideration for inflation, etc. Like 2 years ago, I'm 41 now. So yep. at 39, I started considering this, maybe right. 38. You know, I think a lot more people are thinking about money now, thinking about, whoa, you know, how does this work? Are we going to just continually get fucked by the system?
Right. Well, and that's my point in the Bitcoin Reformation report is that people in the 16th century went through a similar process where all of a sudden there was this crazy guy in Germany who had this pamphlet, the 95 Theses, and he was questioning the Catholic Church. And because of the printing press, you could produce books and pamphlets at an extremely low cost. Like, the price of books dropped from a year's wage to the price of a chicken over a century. And so because of that technological progress, all of a sudden these ideas of this one fringe person in Germany were spread on thousands and thousands of copies across Europe. And he was saying, I mean, this guy was making fun of the Pope. Like, he was genuinely engaging in extreme satire and things like that. And so, yeah, all of a sudden, whether you agreed or disagreed with him, all of a sudden, people were talking about the legitimacy of the Catholic Church. And so I think similarly, even, of course, Satoshi is nowhere near as, I'm not saying at all that he's like a Martin Luther. He's nowhere near as political and blasphemous and whatever, but just kind of like by suggesting, like letting this little balloon float that, oh, maybe we can have our own digital currency that's private. All of a sudden, everybody's questioning the legitimacy of these central banks. Like, do we even need you? And then there's this reaction from them where they're like, well, we're going to do our own digital currency. And we don't really know what it's going to look like. We don't even know if it makes sense. But, you know.
Well, and digital currencies are the big thing, man.
And that's the Counter-Reformation, which is exactly what the Catholic Church did back then. They had a response and because they kind of want to prove their relevance. And you kind of see them, you know, you kind of hear their head crack about like, oh, trying to come up with something to show that they're still relevant and important and that their monopoly is justified. And I think that's how I see, you know, China being friendly towards blockchain and like all these like Libra and these private, you know, private currency initiatives. It's like, you know, that similarly in the Protestant Reformation, there were all of a sudden, yes, there was Luther, the radical Lutheranism, but there were a lot of like, you know, Catholicism light, where like all of a sudden you had these like kind of softer spin-offs. So it's kind of amusing to take a step back and imagine like, oh wow, this is really kind of a societal shift. Like, this giant iceberg might be like turning upside down slowly. So yeah, I agree. Like, I mean, all of a sudden people it's like, it's not even we're allowed to question money all of a sudden, but it's like now it's conceivable. Like, oh yeah, there's this counterexample of Bitcoin. And so all of a sudden we have something real to talk about.
I'm going to tell you now what my favorite part of the whole article was. The one intuitive parallel, the very essence of rebellion. That was the thing where I was like, because I read it and I was like, I love this. And I got to that, but I was like, ah, now this is like a movement. This is like something I want to be part of. Like, when the history books are written and if Bitcoin does change society in like in a better way, if it does improve money, if it does fix things, as Michael Goldstein would say, it's like, I want to be on the right side of this. You know, I want to be on the side of the rebellion. And then when you tell me like Bitcoin is a rebellion, I'm like, fuck, I really want to be part of this.
Well, I mean, I would say to each his own. What I was after mainly is I didn't mean it as like a rallying cry, but mainly to be like, you know, what at least to give people a framework that allows them to better make a choice or a decision. Was it like the battle cries? Is that what you mean?
So you listed the three things under. I mean, I'm taking parts out, but you're like, it's the very essence of rebellion. Don't trust, verify.
Mm.
HODL, not your keys, not your Bitcoin. It's the things that go with it. It's almost like Bitcoin is the rebellion, but like these are the rallying cries, a part of it. And I loved that.
Yeah, and so because to me, it kind of maybe it looks a bit frivolous to see it. Like, is that really part of the research to like look at these memes and stuff like that? But you have to remember that the Protestant Reformation was a populist movement. It was a popular movement. It, like a lot of people who they weren't theologians, and you know, it was really kind of carried by the people. And so it makes sense that in a way, this complex movement was summarized in very pithy statements. And so at the time, it was like, for example, sola fide. It meant like, and also sola scriptura. So sola fide meant you don't need a priest to get into heaven. Faith alone is enough, right? God can see beyond the priest. He can like stare right into your brain. And so if as long as you're pure on the inside and you're faithful, you're going to get to heaven. So that's like a way to say, you don't have to trust a middleman. You can just talk straight to God. Like only faith is enough. And the other one was sola scriptura, which meant only scripture. So like all these theological interpretations, and they were making fun at the time of scholastics who had these, you know, complicated interpretations of the Bible and trying to marry it with Aristotle. They said like, which I don't think it was a great thing, but it just happened. They said, to hell with all that. We're going to translate the Bible into German, into Dutch, into English, and then you can engage with the Word of God directly. Like, so you don't need the middleman, this monopolist provider of religious services, which was the Catholic Church. And so that's where I see the parallel today. All these like slogans in Bitcoin that is like, you know, vires in numeris. It's like, you know, faith in numbers. We don't trust the bank. You don't need to trust the bank. We put our faith, like the Winklevoss say, we put our faith in a system of mathematics.
Yeah.
Or like, don't trust verifier. Exactly. It's what it says. Like, don't trust the middleman, run your own full node, and you are empowered. And so that's that kind of spirit is, I feel very strongly, is parallel to what happened back then.
Next up, I talked to Tuat more about the Bitcoin Reformation, but before that, I have a message from my amazing sponsors. So first up, Wire, and thank you to everyone who's taken the time to check them out. This is the final month of their sponsorship, so if you've not checked them out yet, please make sure you do. I want to make sure they get the most out of this sponsorship. So Wire, they're helping companies across the space offer Bitcoin onboarding. It doesn't matter whether you are a solo developer or a large team. If you are looking to simplify user onboarding and offer your users a fast and easy way to purchase Bitcoin, then you need to talk to Wire. They have been crushing it since 2013 and are focused on taking care of the heavy lifting in terms of compliance, payments, and liquidity so you can focus on building your core offering. Your idea could be the next killer app, so don't let the regulators kill it. To find out more, reach out to Wire or create a developer account at sendwire.com, which is sendwire.com. And lastly, this week, we have Dropbit, the best mobile wallet in the business, and Dropbit have absolutely killed it this year. They have crushed 2019. Can't wait to see what they're going to do next year. Well, I know a little bit about what they're going to do next year, and I can't wait to tell you all about it. But have you downloaded the app yet? I know thousands and thousands of you have so far, which is utterly amazing. So thank you so much. And what a year, though. So many good things. So when I started working with them, you could text Bitcoin to people. But now you can tweet Bitcoin to people. They've added Lightning support. They've got Batch32 address support. They even allow for onboarding within the app. They've done so much stuff this year. They've absolutely killed it. Seriously, if you've not checked out Dropbit, then what are you doing with your life? Definitely go and download the app. And if you want me to unlock your Lightning wallet, just reach out to me on Twitter. I will get through all of them. I will send you some sats. It's available for the iPhone and Android. Just head over to dropbit.app, which is dropbit.app. All right, now I'm going to pick out the thing that was the surprise to me, right? The part of it that was a surprise, because I want to get to the practical parts of this, like the reality. Actually, I just want to get to the conclusions, because that's the really interesting part. It's the way it's almost like your predictions that I think super interesting. But the one thing that stood out to me, and I didn't see coming, was the part on IEOs. Do you see that as IEOs on Bitcoin, or do you still see the continuation of altcoins?
So an IEO is initial exchange offering. It's basically an exchange that issues a token to help them finance something. Usually they have some kind of trouble and they need to raise more cash as a buffer, or for whatever reason, maybe they want to expand their services and they don't want to dilute their equity. They don't want to just sell shares in the mm-hmm. company. And so they're like, here's this token. And the way it works is almost like an annuity. It's like a basic life insurance contract where you invest a lump sum. And then the way an annuity works is that then you get a kind of a fixed income over time until the lender pays you back the initial investments. And so in theory, it could go on forever. But of course, you're not paid dividends on these IEOs. Well, what they do is they promise to, on a monthly basis or quarterly basis, go into the market, buy back a certain amount of tokens and burn them. Mm-hmm. And so therefore making the token more scarce and therefore transferring value to the investors. And so to me, that's a similar idea where you get to share in the profitability of the exchange. And the parallel that I'm seeing there is that, and in a way it doesn't have anything to do with Bitcoin, right? It's just you're issuing a security and then these people get financial benefit from it. And it's way more feasible to do that than to say, we're going to just borrow Bitcoin from the public. Because of course, you know, who knows how high Bitcoin can go, mm-hmm. which is exactly how annuities work. Like the idea is that this is why annuities were so popular in a deflationary world, because straight out debt was dangerous, right? If I owe, you know, whatever, 100 gold coins and there's gradual deflation, then I can basically dig myself a hole that I can't get out of. Mm-hmm. But if I have an annuity contract where I get a fixed amount of money and then the what I owe is expressed as a percentage of my revenue, well, then that's predictable, right? Mm-hmm. If the grain prices go down or whatever, I still keep paying that same percentage of revenue. So that's kind of a model that works in a deflationary world. So the parallel that I see is these annuities were very popular and issued by villages in Holland, especially, who were besieged by the Spanish. They had to build up their dikes, they had to raise their walls, they had to build defenses, they had to sometimes hire mercenaries from England, etc. Maybe some of your ancestors helped us out, who knows? Maybe. And the investors, of course, sometimes one of these villages lost, and then you just, you know, you were wiped out. But over, you know, in the long run, it was actually a very profitable and mutually beneficial agreement. And that's kind of where I think there is some argument to be made that these offshore exchanges, especially like Bitfinex, if anything, they're embattled, right? Whether you agree with, you know, how they run their business or not, they are kind of under threat by all kinds of authorities that have lots of things to deal with. So I think it makes economic sense for them to issue these tokens. And I don't see any scenario where this would stop happening, right? It's just a clear win-win situation where there's historical precedent. And of course, there's people that want Bitfinex to keep running because maybe they built their business model on it, et cetera, just like back then. The citizens who lived in those places were invested in, you know, the city not being sacked and their houses being burned.
Wow. Okay. So you see this, do you see it, like you say IEOs, like the proliferation, but do you see this being used as a tool by any kind of company?
Sure. Yeah, I mean, why not? But I guess I would have to think about it more. It might not, I think it especially makes sense for a company that has a revenue stream that's substantial and at the same time is facing some existential risks mm-hmm. where all of a sudden, you know, there's the Spanish army. Oh my God, they're only, you know, 2 weeks away. We need money now.
Yeah.
That's when because it is a significant cost, right? To commit mm-hmm. to, you know, paying part of the revenue to these outside investors, you know, that can hurt. And so you'd only maybe do it if you're really under threat. I'm sure Bitfinex, if they had, you know, unlimited capital, they would maybe raise it in another way. If there were VCs, you know, up the wazoo, they would. But it's because they're so embattled that they kind of resort to this particular type of contract, I think.
Right. So let's get into the conclusions. Right. I'm going to encourage everyone to read it because I think they should read it before they listen to the interview. And if we had 3 hours, I would dive into a history lesson with you because it is so fascinating. Mm. But the conclusions are the practical, it's the practical output of this. But firstly, I like the fact you brought in the Eric Weinstein quote, the fit ideas beat unfit ideas, because it's very true. Bad ideas do win, mm-hmm. but fit ideas do be unfed ideas. I thought that was great, but I very much love this bit you wrote. And again, I'm going to quote you, but meanwhile, the Bitcoin ecosystem is maturing in all aspects of its economy, in particular in deposit banking, insurance, lending, and derivatives, and early forms of life insurance. If this process persists, Bitcoin's layer protocol suite could become a global powerhouse and potential alternative to the IMFS. Like, that was a really like powerful quote for me to read, because what it made me do is sit back and go, do you know what? I need to always stop thinking about price and look at the growth of the ecosystem. Look at the growth of companies. Look at the place we are now recording this kind of company, like Unchained, BlockFi, those kind of companies. Like, there is a real shadow financial system being built with Bitcoin.
Yeah, I agree.
But I think I'm going back to the point here of looking through the standard lens and then the wide lens. The standard lens, you can look at Bitcoin and go, the price is down, it's dying, or it's not being used for transactions. Whereas I see, Chu, you're looking at the wide lens and you're seeing the growth of the ecosystem, right, and the build up of services in Bitcoin that makes this a real shadow economic financial system.
Yeah, right. It's almost like if you imagine, you know, 16th century Protestant merchants, just imagine that they're one company and that you can invest in them, how volatile would that have been, right, to invest in that? Like, you know, all of a sudden there's this giant army, they're sending 100,000 soldiers a year, like, you know. But at the same time, you see that they're like, you know, the ships that they built are like the best in the entire world. They finally cracked the technology that allows them to explore uncharted territories and make it back safely, which is, you had to push navigational technology a little further to do that. And so that's a massive breakthrough. So in a way, if you looked at the fundamentals, you could tell where it was going to go. Like, these guys were going to just kill it. And they did. I mean, eventually, that's this kind of what I'm so excited about too, as part of one of the discoveries, at least for me, like all historians know this, but New York City was founded by the Dutch. Right? Incredibly, it was just a trading hub, and the idea of religious tolerance wasn't from some ideological zeal. It was just pragmatism. It was just like, you know, if we want to make this thing work, we're going to have to be tolerant. And so, you know, Jews are welcome and everybody's welcome. As long as you don't kill each other, you know, we're happy to have you. On the island of Manhattan, there was a priest actually who went there, and he was horrified. He called it Babel, because even though there were only 500 people living on the island of Manhattan, there were 18 different languages spoken. He thought it was just horrifying, right? Everybody should, of course, speak Latin, which is, you know, or whatever, or Greek, or some kind of divine language. And so you know, if you could have bought an ETF backed by badass Protestant rebels, and not just rebels, but really merchants, I would have gone long all day long. It would have been super volatile, but there was this amazing strength from it. And it was decentralized, right? They were not, and that was part of the weakness of the Spanish, for example. Yes, they were a powerhouse, but it was very centralized, and Spanish merchants suffered by it. They had to pay high taxes. There were all kinds of rules that made it hard for them that the Dutch did not have any problems with. And so to me, I do try to look beyond the day-to-day volatility and kind of try to see the big picture.
And when you're looking at the big picture, are there any key parts that you think are missing within the Bitcoin ecosystem?
No, I think everything is being worked on. Uh-huh. Of course, you know, nothing's perfect, and so there's always areas where things can improve. We need better deposit insurance. You know, we need better deposit security. Like, we need more robust multi-sig solutions. That's kind of still early on, but some very, very promising things are in the pipeline. I think that we probably need just more information. Like, we need to be able to have more transparency of the exchanges and better auditability of institutions, because Bitcoin is highly auditable as a technology, but it doesn't always translate to the companies that are built on Bitcoin. I think we need also more clarity that, like, there's a lot of alchemy out there, which is like, you know, there's like real science happening, but then there's also all these quacks that are saying, I've invented perpetual motion and time travel. And I think that's, you know, a lot of the altcoins are kind of like that, but that gets sorted out with time. Like, it's just, we need time.
Do you see Bitcoin eventually destroying and taking out fiat money, or do you see it as that it was something that will always sit alongside it?
My best guess right now would be that it is going to be similar to how things evolved with religion, where the Catholic Church never disappeared, right? As far as I know, there's still a billion Catholics around, but the political strength and clout and power of the Catholic Church has very significantly diminished in favor of much more secular ways of doing things. It's not like, oh, some other religion monopolized everything. It's like, no, religious tolerance, that's what happened. And so in translating that to Bitcoin, it would mean that it's not that the Church of Bitcoin is going to take over the Church of the Federal Reserve. It's more that there's going to be financial tolerance. That's, you know, whatever country bets on financial tolerance is going to win, which means mm-hmm. that they allow for Bitcoin to be used as of money and et cetera, et cetera.
Well, you said like Bitcoin tolerance versus intolerance, it will become a major political fault line.
Yeah.
And it's quite interesting, again, when you saw that, that actually made me think of the David Marcus testimony in Congress, because I was like...
The PayPal CFO? No, COO?
Well, he was.
He was high up in PayPal at some point. So and now Libra.
Yeah, because there were clearly people within Congress who have understood Bitcoin and very supportive, even though they know the implications for government and politics. And there were those who were clearly, maybe not scared, but intolerant, mm-hmm. maybe scared or maybe think it's stupid or worried about losing control. But you got to see that over like a 2 5-hour sessions, whatever, or 3-hour sessions over 2 days. You actually got to see how politicians would think about this.
Very, very polarizing.
Yeah.
I mean, really, it's like people are so, and that's also, again, why I chose the millennials, because if anything, they're less invested. If you're like 55 years old and you've been in finance, you, in a way, you almost by definition are very invested in all these relationships that have to do with that monopoly. So it's a lot harder to just flip sides and be like, oh, you know, I'm now really excited about, or also even to have a mentality of live and let live, because maybe your banker friends are going to be kind of shunning you after that.
Well, I just had Nelson on, who's the OTC guy from Kraken, who was an ex-Wall Street guy, Bear mm-hmm. Stearns, JP Morgan, I think. But he was saying, look, when you've got to like 50, 55, and, you know, why are you going to risk your retirement, which is 5-10 years away, by recommending this new volatile, crazy asset? There's no point. There's absolutely no point taking this risk. You know, stick with the status quo, take your retirement, go and live your life out. But and I had never even thought about it like that. I was like, why the fuck are these people not...
Career risk.
Yeah, career risk. Oh, yeah. Why are they not just introducing Bitcoin? But that's why it's like almost potentially it's a generational shift. Yeah.
I mean, I'm reminded of Thomas Kuhn with his... you know, the structure of scientific revolutions, where he also says that like a new paradigm is introduced into science usually by some young guys, some rogue scientists, and they propose it. And then for a long time, it's kind of ignored until an entire generation retires. And then the new generation can finally kind of acknowledge the paradigm shift. And part of that is just career risk. If you're 50 years old and you're going to endorse this radical new theory that puts everything upside down, maybe your colleagues are not going to like that so much.
So the next thing you put, which again is kind of funny because of where we're sat recording this, but you said Bitcoin's primary drivers will be saving, lending, and underwriting. Mm-hmm. Talk me through that. And by the way, can you talk through underwriting? Because I don't fully understand it myself.
Well, I mean, the idea is that Bitcoin is on the way to become the ultimate reserve asset, mm-hmm. which means it's highly liquid. And it retains its value, and it even grows in value over time, which is that's the perfect. If you wanna invest in someone, you wanna give them some money, and you want them to put up some collateral. Well, then I would say Bitcoin is almost the ideal collateral because it can be liquidated in a day, right? And so mm-hmm. you can get your money back. Even if this guy's business endeavor totally fails, it's backed by Bitcoin. Therefore, you can get your money back. So I think it's really on the way to become the ultimate collateral. And actually, in the report, I make this analogy with the VOC, which was the East India Company. The world's first IPO happened in 1609 when they founded this VOC company. And so there were stock certificates. And these stock certificates were in this very big enterprise that was generating lots and lots of cash and that kept growing. And it became used as collateral for all kinds of activities in the Dutch economy. And it was just that was responsible for dropping the interest rates by 30%, wow. right? Just because there was liquid collateral available, all of a sudden, if I lent you money, you could put up some VOC shares as collateral, and then I felt all of a sudden a lot more comfortable to lend you money. So there's a lot more capital available all of a sudden. And so that's kind of what I wanted to point out, is like that these very basic functions that sometimes we even ignore in the fog of like smart contracts and all these like buzzwords from 2017, these very basic functions can actually be extremely powerful. Just, you know, using it as a collateral to underwrite all kinds of things. You could underwrite you can use it to underwrite insurance as well.
Well, one of the interesting things as well I've noticed, because I work with BlockFi, they're a sponsor, and I know the guys here Unchained very well. One of the interesting things is when you refer to saving and lending, they kind of tend to shift depending on whether in a bull or bear market. So in the bear market, the lending was quite big. You know, people wanted to borrow money because because they needed access to cash. And as we kind of came out of a bear market and the market started to grow, the saving, because people didn't want to give away their Bitcoin. So it's almost like it follows the ebb and flow of the market.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. I mean, there was also some tax arbitrage there, because like, you know, you might not want to sell your Bitcoin at a certain date. You might not want to wait until date X, but then you need cash now. So, you know, this is kind of what wealthy people always do, is they, you know, that was always a mystery to me. Like, you know, if you're a billionaire, why do you have any debt? But like, there's something, the strategic debt, where you say, oh, well, let's incur some debt now, and then we can defer our taxes to the next year or something like that.
All right, so the next thing was interesting as well, because you said collaborative custody to become an industry standard. And I just thought, bank.
Well, I mean, there's always going to be third party custodians. The question is, how are things organized and who do you have to trust? And so the Coinbase model is just, you know, you send your Bitcoin to Coinbase, they hold all the private keys, and that's it. And so if they go bust, or if they have kind of an internal problem where somebody gets access to those keys, you're done for. But the idea with collaborative custody is that you involve multiple parties so that the risk of collusion becomes smaller, especially if you think about multiple companies. Because, of course, like Coinbase, it's not like one guy holds all the keys. They do have internally some kind of system, but that's a black box. Like, we don't have access to that. We don't know exactly how that happens. Whereas if you as an individual can set up a multi-sig wallet solution where very specifically designated companies are responsible for parts of the process, then all of a sudden it becomes a lot more transparent. And then you can just come up with all kinds of smart contracts, really. I mean, I know people throw it around all the time, but this is actually a real smart contract that's useful, where, for example, you can build in some kind of clawback idea or you can have an emergency button that you can push if something happens that you don't like, and then the funds are bumped to some address that you still control, or if you, for example, don't do anything with the key for a long time, maybe automatically the control is reverted to you. So the reason why I'm trying to emphasize this in the report is that it was based on what I saw happened with the Bank of Amsterdam, which was the most reputable gold bank, the just full reserve bank in Europe at the time. And they had a very complicated security protocol, and it was so well regarded that people were willing to pay an AGO for funds that were held at that bank, which basically meant 1 ounce of gold held at the bank, you would be willing to pay more than 1 ounce of gold for that asset. So, and the reason was that it was very, you know, very secure. So you would pay for security, but also because then you could use it as collateral. There's basically services built on top of it. You could buy VOC shares with it, things like that. And so just kind of seeing that, for example, they had four separate CFAs, like kind of like who were looking at the books, like they had four separate levels of controls built in. And so that kind of, the idea was like, we're under siege here. We don't know who to trust. We have like droves of new immigrants coming in. We're very prosperous, but like, how do we do this right? It's just like, well, you would divide the labor. And so that's the idea behind collaborative custody. So logically speaking, there must be some significant appeal for that going forward.
Yeah. Okay, you covered this. You talked about offshore banking may transform into Bitcoin banking.
Yeah. Yeah, I think so. I mean, Obama said it. Bitcoin is like a bank in your pocket.
Yeah.
Or an offshore bank in your pocket. No, I mean, if you look at traditional offshore banking, it's kind of under threat. And And it is, because they are reliant on the IMFS, the International Monetary and Financial System. And so if they want to keep that connection, they have to abide by these international rules, which is, you know, is the equivalent of that, you know, what Rome says matters. It's like the Pope says X, Y, or Z. We're a Catholic country. I have to abide by it. So it doesn't matter if you're, you know, so a Swiss bank is going to have to open up their database to some kind of FBI, it doesn't matter if it's US or another one, if that's what the rules say. And so I think that better privacy is available in the Bitcoin sphere, and it will grow. And it just makes sense to me that gradually, and this is not without even going into the moral question, because people, there is obviously lots of controversy about offshore banking, but I think it's clear that economically there's always going to be significant demand for moving funds offshore. And the reason why you want to do that privately is well established. Like if you're, for example, a Brazilian entrepreneur, you know, you have the risk of asset seizure in your own country because there's not really a lot of rule of law. So that's a reason to move your funds offshore. But then if your privacy is compromised and some database leaks that you have $10 million sitting in a Swiss bank, all of a sudden your family is a lot more at risk for example, kidnapping risk or things like that. So anyway, I just want to say that I think it's here to stay, offshore banking. And right now, because of all these transparency and KYC rules, AML KYC rules, it's kind of, if offshore banking becomes entirely transparent, well, that's kind of missing the point. Like that's part of the reason why it exists in the first place. So then, you know, entrepreneurial banks are going to venture into different territory, for example, Bitcoin.
All right, we've got two left that I want to cover. Conscious of time. Okay, Bitcoin to mature quickly. Bonds, annuity, loans, and insurance. I didn't get insurance before, but you talked about that last time I spoke to you. You talked about insurance.
Yeah, or like life insurance,
yeah.
Even, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I think Bitcoin is just a natural asset to be used as the basis for a life insurance industry. Like, if you look internationally, life insurance has become less and less relevant, and banking has grown more and more relevant, and in financial terms as well. In the 1930s, the life insurance industry was bigger in the U.S. than the banking industry in the U.S. Like that's how. If you walk around in Chicago and all these older cities, you see these buildings and they say like mutual trust, this and that. Those were life insurance companies. Like you can still see it. And the reason why it lost its relevance in the economy is that a life insurance contract is expressed in the money. So if I have $1 million life insurance contract, that's great if we live in a deflationary world, right? If the money increases in value, then I'm happy with $1 million down the road. But if the money erodes in value and that $1 million could maybe only be enough to buy a bicycle 20 years down the road, then that's a lot less interesting. So there's a lot of research that backs up that idea that in an inflationary environment, life insurance is going to decline. And so, you know, because Bitcoin is so deflationary, my logical argument is, well, it could herald a new era of life insurance. And it's brilliant if you think of it. I mean, you can basically invest a little bit of money now to kind of keep your family safe in case you, for some reason, stop being an income provider, right? Mm-hmm. If you die, then your family is at least taken care of. So I would love to see a resurgence of life insurance.
Okay, we're going to finish on my favorite one. I actually texted this to Balaji this morning because I was like, it made me think of him as well. Yeah, so we covered the IEOs. It's Bitcoin savers could accelerate a revolution in the history of thought. And I pondered on it for a while. I was like, what exactly are you getting? Because this doesn't fit with all the others. All the others are kind of part of monetary policy and economics. Right. But this is like almost like, let me tell you what I took from this and tell me if I'm wrong. But this is almost like a shift in the way people think about money, production, consumerism.
Well, I think it's well spotted that it's different from the others, and I kind of snuck it in there.
Yeah.
The very basic analysis that I'm suggesting is just that there's a new class, a new economic class, who has different values, different ideas, and who's going to have a lot of money.
Yeah.
And so they are basically able to sponsor whoever they want. And so chances are that's not going to 100% overlap with whatever is the status quo today. I mean, we're already seeing it. A lot of millennials are kind of jaded thinking about universities. Like, I don't know if you know, if Bitcoiners do become, you know, the new billionaires, if they're going to pour their wealth into, you know, Harvard endowments and things like that, right? So then it's like, well, where are they going to put their money? If it's charitable money and things like that. So, and usually that, and so it's possible that we will see these new educational institutions that will, you know, we'll see authors being sponsored to do certain things or radical. I mean, already to some extent, the .com entrepreneurs, the .com billionaires, they have sponsored things that are kind of fall outside of the status quo. Like, I mean, I think Mark Zuckerberg has this idea of, you know, eradicating aging and all these, you know, and then there's Jeff Bezos who's like, let's go to space and like build stuff like that.
But this is the billionaires. The billionaires usually want to do one of three things. They want to go to space. Mm. They would never want to die. And they want a bunker in case World War III kicks off.
But I mean, but that's not always been the case. There was a time when billionaires that they would just build libraries. So they were like, you know, let's bring knowledge to the people. Or they would sponsor the church or things like that.
Right, so your point was where the money gets directed. Yeah, okay, because yeah. I was thinking it more in just like this is a shift. This could cause a generational shift in the way we think about money and society.
Yeah,
like
yeah.
The world could change.
Yeah, no. And so I think that's going to happen, but... So it goes to the Eric Weinstein's point is that like, you know, well, yes, these radical and crazy ideas, they are around and these radical thinkers, but right now they're kind of scraping to get by, right? They're like the sophists, like they're kind of ignored. But if you have an entire economic class that is favorable to their ideas, all of a sudden they could gain a lot more prominence. And that's usually when the history books get written. If they really, you know, like kind of like if you look at... the city of Leiden, which is where a lot of the Protestants refugees went to in Holland, I mean, they started a university that became like the intellectual heart of the Netherlands. And then they had a big impact. Like all these thinkers there, they then kind of taught, you know, they were educating the youth. And, you know, that's kind of where the history of thought gets written in my mind.
Well, listen, again, I'm going to say it's a really fantastic piece. It's without doubt my favorite. And I think I've read everything you've written. I've certainly read everything on Medium and I've read everything that you've published, I think.
Wow, I'm flattered.
Well, I meant to if I'm interviewing you. But but I do. I love it. I have a feeling not as many people read this as much as Bitcoin is in heavy accumulation because... You know, that gets to the incentives, the accumulation. But I'm going to encourage everyone to read this before they... I'm going to just say, if you haven't read it, don't fucking listen to this interview. But you've put the pressure on now for yourself because, you know, your next scripture, I expect to be of equally high...
Maybe it needs
standard.
To be a book then, right?
Maybe. Yeah, I think you've got a book in you, dude.
I would say, like, this is the one to read with a glass of wine and, like, just kind of, you know... And it really was a labor of love. Like, you know, I really enjoyed diving into this and I love trying to, like, make it come to life. So I, like, included a lot of, like, illustrations and paintings and things like that.
Do you know where you're going next, though? Do you know what your next thing's going to be?
No, I never really do, no.
Well, you've put the pressure on. If it's a book... It's going to be the Bitcoin
like,
Bible.
Honestly, like this stuff that I write is just like I just write for myself, and that's always, you know, if I'm proud of it, that's enough, and then I'm happy, and then if it's not that popular, like so be it. But you know,
well, this one framed a lot for me. It gave me a lot more perspective. It also reminded me of the kind of low time preference. This is all playing out as we need it to. This stop thinking about price, stop thinking about use, just. Everything is falling into place, and Tura, it's a fucking fantastic piece. So I will be saying everyone they've got to read it. So, well, listen, we've got to our time. I appreciate your time as ever. It's always good for me to have you on the show because it always gets me tens of thousands of downloads. talking to you. Just for people who don't know you, and everyone does, but for anyone who doesn't, tell them where they can find you and follow you, and more specifically find this, and I will share it in the show notes.
I would just say Google my name. The first link is my Twitter account, and I've stickied the report onto my profile. So just go to my profile. It'll be the top tweet that has the link.
And it's Tuur Demeester, TuurDemeester.
Two U's and four E's.
There we go. All right, man. Well, listen, always a pleasure. Thank you for coming on.
Likewise. Thank you.
Okay, so what did you think of that one? Do you enjoy that as much as I did? I do love talking to Tuur. I think he's been on the show three times now, and each one has been amazing. And he does write some amazing stuff, but I thought this one was especially good. And I think it's his best piece of writing. I think I actually told him to that in the show.
I will make sure I leave a link to it in the show notes, so definitely go and check it out. You might want to read it before you get into the interview. And if you do like this wine, you should check out my other interviews with Tour. They're all linked in the show notes. And if you've got any feedback on the show, do hit me up. My email address is hello@whatbitcoindid.com. And if you do want to support the show, if you enjoy listening to What Bitcoin Did, then there is a bunch of things you can do to help. It doesn't matter whether you leave them a review, you share it out with your friends and family, whatever you do, it all helps with the show. It's all up on my website, whatbitcoindid.com. Just click on the support section. And as I said, I'm back in Bedford right now. I'm back for 10 days. Got a whole bunch of shit I need to catch up on. But next week, I'm going to be heading out to Uruguay for LeBitConf. I'm going to be flying via Buenos Aires, and then I'm hopefully going to be heading out to Bolivia for a couple of days for my other show, Defiant. So hopefully I will get to hang out with some of you out there. As ever, if you've got any questions, do reach out to me. And apart from that, I hope you have a lovely week.